Welcome to the Food Fans interview from Frogop. How do you build a business that has maximum impact on its customers' health while having minimum impact on the environment? It's a challenge that I'm sure a lot of food and drink businesses are wrestling with. Today's guest, Al Duffield of Vital Drinks, has set out to build a drinks brand with those goals right at its heart. He's also raised some serious investment from some true industry veterans, so I'm really excited to find out all about it. Welcome, Al.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for having us on.
Excellent. Well, let's get down to it. So I guess the first question is, can you give us a bit of information about how Vital came to be and why you started the business?
Unfortunately, there wasn't a eureka moment. You heard some of the more romantic brands cooked up in their own kitchen with their sort of grandmother's recipe. That wasn't the case for us. We were much more sort of data led, but there had always been the plan to start up a business. And I'd rather naively signed up to a silly challenge a couple of years ago, which was 10 consecutive Ironmans in 10 consecutive days. And the training for this was pretty grueling, as you might imagine. And the selection of stuff on the market for drinks in terms of pills and powders were endless. But when it came to natural ingredients and getting health benefits sort of into a can, there wasn't much out there. And there was a big disconnect between healthy function and the rest of the market, unlike what we see in the US and the rest of Europe. So that's where sort of the initial idea and sort of the opportunity around functional drinks originally arose. But as I mentioned, we've always been a data-led business. So just before starting something up, and we had a few ideas, we invested a lot of the cash into and resource into data itself and various panels and various consumer research. And this was when functional drinks, I mean, it wasn't even that long ago, but it awkwardly sort of added on to the edge of water or even energy and appeared in different aisles and different retailers and didn't really have a home. Fast forward today, almost all the retailers have moved to functional bays. Our focus was ultimately creating functional bays and creating clean and healthy function that feels good and is affordable as well. So with that data, we ultimately saw the opportunity, and the key areas of growth were CBD, vitamins, and gut health. We think CBD almost sits in its own space entirely, and has potentially various restrictions coming in and out. So our focus was around vitamins and gut health, and that's where Vital was born. So it wasn't a cute romantic story from a kitchen, but it was very much data led, which I know isn't as fun.
Did you work on a product and then the data at the same time, or did you do all the data and planning work and then develop a product?
We'd actually narrowed it down to three options around store, and we were very fortunate to have the backers that were sort of with us from day one, no matter what we were going to do. We committed to drinks, and then from there on in started the trademark process, the wider investment piece, and also, of course, developing and launching the product itself.
What were you doing before? Have you always been in the food industry or drinks particularly? Or
I've always been in food. I mean, there's a lot of sort of skills that you can take over from that into drinks. But I've been very fortunate enough to work for some awesome companies, including like Propercorn, which has since went to Proper and then Warp, but also Merchant Gourmet and Deliciously Ella. The majority of my, albeit relatively short, career was spent at Propercorn. I was fortunate to arrive in their sort of hyper growth stage, and I was a tiny, tiny cog in that, but the learning was phenomenal. And it was set up by two amazing founders, and they had an amazing leadership team behind them, two big PE firms backing them as well. So to be part of that trajectory with them and the learning that that brought was very special. I was at a Young Foodies event last week, and four of the front seven in the row had gone on to start their own companies, and they were all from Propercorn. That was the culture that Cass and Ryan wanted to instill in its workforce, and it was always encouraged. And I think they sort of took inspiration from the innocent days, where a lot of the innocent guys and girls went on to start their own thing. And I think there's a lot of culture similarities between innocent and proper. That play hard, work hard environment, but equally just encouraging those to go and do it themselves.
That's interesting. So it's almost like a mindset within the company, but entrepreneurial, or?
Yes. I mean, there's a PE firm described Propercorn as recently as sort of a conveyor belt of startups, which I think was Cass and Ryan's, and also credit to the CEO, Mike Hedges, Ali Adams, or the other amazing leaders in that team that's what they wanted. And that's what they wanted to instill in the team. So yeah, I mean, credit to them. And I probably speak for all the other founders that have come out of Propicorn. A huge, huge thanks to them and everything that they taught us, not just instilling that culture within the company, but also the levels of investment that they put into the team in terms of learning was yeah, huge. So very fortunate enough to have been there for a couple of years, as well as learning lots at the likes of Merchant Gourmet and Delicious Leno.
You've kind of touched on this, but what do you feel about the state of the functional drink space? Did you feel that something was broken or missing, or people just missing an opportunity?
A big disconnect between health and function. I mean, not all functional drinks are healthy. Some don't try to be, but there is an association with function and health. And if we look to the US and we look at other pockets of Europe, you have high levels of function and then not necessarily much of the bad stuff. But in the UK, you had high levels of function, and along with it came immense amounts of sugar, but also vast amounts of artificial sweeteners and ultra processed ingredients.
Right.
And there felt like there was a disconnect there. And just because you had high levels of function does not then give you a free pass to put all the other stuff in, whether that be high levels of sugar or UPFs or artificial sweeteners. So we wanted to bridge that gap. So have the high levels of function, have natural ingredients, use British spring water, have the high levels of function. So for the examples, the vitamins or the fiber for the gut health. But then at the same time, don't add all the additional sugar and artificial sweeteners. And I think we're going to probably hopefully come on to talk about UPF, but it's so big in the market right now. So yeah, we thought there was a disconnect there, and we've so far proven to be right.
The gut health side, was that from the start, or is that something that's kind of evolved with the business?
So we launched, and again, I sound like a very boring data nerd, but everything we did was around the data. So the fastest growing area in the market was still liquids in cans as consumers move away from plastics. However, having said that, it was still a very small portion of the market compared to, let's say, sparkling in cans. So we launched with the fastest growing subsegment, which was still in cans, as an easier way to pivot ourselves in. So that was the still vitamin waters. And then pretty quickly, we launched the sparkling vitamin waters off the back of that. And then the last couple of months have launched the gut health sodas as well. So Vital's mission statement is to become the UK's favourite functional drinks brand. And our ultimate aim is to be category champions in the gut health sodas, as well as the vitamin drinks as well.
When I tried the drinks, I found it a nice, easy alternative to a Barocca or something like that. But obviously, with the added gut health benefits, it seems like a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's 10 o'clock now and I'm drinking one, but I guess I'm very biased. With the gut health
You got a
sodas,
fridge full, I imagine.
yeah, exactly. I'm the biggest customer. We also added, I mean, within our gut health sodas, we've got our low calorie, zero sugar, no artificial sweeteners, natural ingredients, but we also added your daily dose of vitamin C and D. The focus is very much around the fiber and the prebiotics within it. However, we also added, for good measure, 100% of your daily dose of vitamin C and D. So it's sort of ticking multiple boxes in one. But the two ranges are very much a vitamin range and then a gut health range.
Well, how do you decide which flavors to go for, actually? I suppose it's probably a nice simple question.
I fear you're going to already be bored of me answering with data. With the flavor, it's a huge amount of research. Key consumer decision going in tends to be either citrus or sort of berry related. So we had to have one of each. So we launched with strawberry and yuzu. Strawberry because it was the best seller in flavored water in the market, and yuzu because it was the highest trending. And then lemon and lime was our second flavor. I'm not going to pretend we were the first ones to put lemon and lime together. But again, it was the best seller on the market, and we wanted to tick off the citrus as well as sort of the berry options as well. And after that, I mean, we should also thank our phenomenal ingredients house, who have done huge amounts on the market. Hayley, who heads it up, can walk into pretty much any store and pick about 50 SKUs that she's developed. So we're very, very grateful to them, and that's where the credit should go. But the flavors themselves and what we wanted to have in them all stemmed from the initial data that we worked with the investors to get hold of.
So, in terms of developing the product further, or the range further, I suppose more accurately, is that about other flavors, or is it about other functions or other benefits, or both?
It's very easy as functionals taking all the headlines to look at various other functions and think, right, we should do that. But I think what if all the investors were to agree on one thing, it would be do less better. So it's very easy to spread yourselves very thin and sort of get taken by the headlines and the new functions that are emerging. So we're very much sticking to the gut health and the vitamins for the time being, and just building further on the flavors. Currently, we've got two still vitamins, one sparkling and one sparkling gut health. We'd like to get that up to two stills, two sparklings, two gut health. And that's already sort of in the pipeline, and we've got some exciting launches coming up around them.
Excellent. Is that this year or start of next?
Start of 2025, yeah, H1 for 2025. I think it's going to be a very busy year.
There's a lot of benefits and claims with the products. So, from nutrition and the gut health, also the social impact, which I guess we'll talk about later, and the environmental impact. Which is most important for you?
For us, it has before anything else, it has to be taste-led. It sounds painfully obvious, but I think some brands are guilty of just filling space on a shelf or even putting in something from their tail, knowing that it will probably get knocked out in the next range of you, and they're just trying to hold that space until something else can come. So our real focus is taste, and we spend a huge amount of time and resource and ultimately cash getting that absolutely right. We won't launch products unless we believe that we win on blind tastings across the board on any competitor. So before anything else, before we even think about health or commerciality or people and planet promise, it is very much taste-led. After that, if we look at the primary reasons of purchase, it's cost. But then from there, it's the health claims and the people and planet side of things as well. But yeah, it's very, very much taste-led.
There's also claims around, zero calories, zero sugar, and being free from ultra processed ingredients. Which ones do you think resonate best with consumers? UPF seems to be quite a hot topic at the moment. Are you kind of seeing that with your customer base?
Absolutely. I think you've got to then sort of dive down into who your customer base is. And we're going for the 18 to 45 mid-affluent consumer who is after all-encompassing, fast, impulsive health on the go. I know that's a lot to break down in a sentence. But the zero sugar is always jumps out. And the UPF claim, and that includes artificial sweeteners, is taking more of the headlines. I mean, there was an article the grocer did relatively recently that 1 million shoppers a month were leaving UPF. And I think that all stems from the education piece. I think a couple of years ago, people didn't really know what ultra processed foods were. And certainly that mainstream shopper saw zero sugar and zero calories and thought, great, I'm cheating a diet here. That's fantastic. This is a healthy option made easy and accessible and affordable. But I, as we both mentioned, the UPF piece is becoming more and more prominent. So I'd certainly say the zero sugar and zero calories is the primary claims that gets people's attention, especially the consumers that we're going after. But more and more consumers are looking at the back of pack to see if they've got those ultra processed ingredients, and to be able to claim on the side of pack 100% natural ingredients was well, part of the criteria for us from day one. So yeah, zero calories, zero sugar is sort of the headline grabber, but the ultra processed ingredients and artificial sweeteners is very much up and coming.
It's kind of a trade-off, isn't it? As you say, zero calories, zero sugar sounds great.
I think what can be confusing is that the artificial sweeteners and the ultra processed ingredients, the words sound very scientific and artificial. Equally, you have some natural ingredients that sound similar. So I think you then go to the secondary claims that we've got on the side of pack. So it's things like supports immune system might be around, but also you'd have 100% plant-based or natural ingredients. I think the moment you, yeah, but it can be very hard. I mean, we might all eat and drink products with artificial sweeteners in that we didn't really know, because we don't know that osphaltamic K and sucralose and aspartame, the artificial sweeteners, are on the back of pack. It can get very technical. And for your average consumer who you've got 2 seconds with, on shelf is probably not going to read it. But as we say, it is a growing movement and it's an interesting one. There are certainly whispers around the sort of UPF that there might be increased taxes. Obviously, the government put in the sugar tax a few years ago, which did work. So there are potential whispers of sort of around that the same will be done for ultra processed ingredients. And if that is the case, and that's a big if, then ultimately that will lead to CPIs within the market. So we are staying away from ultra processed ingredients from a health perspective, but also the association as well, and potential CPIs that might have in the years to come.
It's probably cost driven, I suppose, more than anything, isn't it, really?
Yeah, exactly. And that artificial ingredients are cheaper.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's understandably why lots of brands lean towards them.
Another interesting area is that you're planting a tree for every can sold. That sounds like a lot of work for you, or you're kind of part of a scheme that helps do that.
It is a lot of work. Our four key pillars were taste, health, environment, and people. And if we don't believe we win in all four, we won't launch a product. There are some amazing schemes out there, like B Corp 1% for the Planet. But what we wanted to do was really translate to the consumer in one sentence. So you see some brands making some big promises around carbon neutrality in years to come. We wanted our promise to be action from day one, and it had to be easy for the consumer to understand immediately. So we plant and maintain one tree for every single can sold. So if we break that down a little bit, because it is a big claim, it had to be, for us, it had to obviously be done. It had to be maintained. It had to be done properly, which we'll come on to talk about afforestation versus reforestation. But it also had to be done by a governing body, and it had to have an effect on the people around it. So it was a tough criteria, and it had to be then also believed as well. So very quickly we worked out that it had to be we had to partner up with a UK and USA registered charity. It couldn't be someone who hasn't gone through the official sort of lines of registration and so on. And we spoke to dozens of charities around the world, and we found an amazing charity called Ripple Africa, who are operate out of the UK and the US, but predominantly most of their work is done in Malawi, which is one of the worst deforested areas in the world, and at the same time is one of the poorest countries in the world. So our project is around reforestation and not afforestation. Planting trees historically can be a very easy avenue for brands and celebrities to greenwash. You'll see the likes of, let's say, Leonardo DiCaprio hopping on a private jet to an eco conference and then saying, "It's fine, I've planted a million trees." That is very much afforestation. And without getting too technical, that's a random piece of land that never had trees on. So they get planted. It's not good for biodiversity, and the odds of the tree surviving are very low. Only around 5% survive. Whereas reforestation is targeting the areas that have had trees on previously and have been chopped down. So you know it's good for biodiversity, and it's very much regenerative rather than planting trees in random areas and them not being maintained. So I think the key area to our promise is that it's planted and maintained. And if any don't make it, we'll replant any that don't. And also the effect it then has on the people around it. So not only is it good for the planet, it also drives cash into an economy that is in desperate need of it. So the external branches are coppiced every few years, leaving the core of the tree to continue to grow. And the branches are used ultimately as a commodity by the locals to build and trade with. And in Malawi, unlike its neighbors, has no natural resource, has very little tourism. It is a country's on its knees. So a commodity to build and trade with is the difference between eating and not eating. So what we're looking to do is give back to the people around it. A lot of these schemes forget that, and don't give back to the surrounding areas, but also make a promise that is tangible and is always on and happens immediately, to the consumer, upon buying any unit.
That's quite a commitment, and seems really, really well thought through as well.
It's not cheap, and we're ultimately looking to take functional mainstream. So yeah, it was certainly a challenge, and we spoke to dozens and dozens of charities. But Ripple Africa are phenomenal, and yeah, in a nutshell, it's a promise that had to be always on, had to be believed, it had to happen, it had to be maintained, and it had to have a positive effect on the people around it.
Good stuff. Where are you currently selling? I know the website is there. Where else are you selling? How have those sales channels evolved, and what works for you?
We launched into six wholesalers off the bat. In March, we sold our first can in March. And we also launched into three contract caterers as well. So the focus has very much been around contract caterers and wholesale, as well as di normal digital places, our D2C, as well as Amazon. And ultimately, off the back of those, is building case studies to take forward and take to the retailers and other outlets that are available. It's been incredibly encouraging seeing. I think it's getting that initial sell in is great, and it's sort of a mini celebration getting those launches in and seeing it in the wholesalers that I've been lucky enough to work with before. However, it's the repeat rates that dictate everything. So watching these wholesalers move from ordering layers to two layers to three layers now to full pallets has been very encouraging. And we also get to see where we're selling out at the end. And for example, we launched in Google. They've ordered multiple pallets in the last 4 weeks. So it's all good case studies.
In Google, like their offices.
Their offices, correct. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Google was one of our first customers.
As you say, when you've made the listing, that's kind of, it's almost like the work just begins then, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, you've got the pull through, a fair amount of field work, samplings. You can't just put some random promotions in and the odd incentive and hope for the best. There is a lot of work that goes in, goes. There is a lot of work that happens after. As you say, it's sort of step one.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously an important step and something to celebrate, but. Then the real work begins.
Yeah.
Is your ultimate aim supermarkets and so
It
forth?
is. Yeah, we've got an exciting year coming up. But equally, we don't want to be that brand that launches into retail and forgets everywhere else. We want to do, as mentioned earlier, less better. So anywhere we're in, we want to activate properly and give them enough time of day and not just forget about them just because they're technically not the biggest customer anymore. So our focus is very much high street wholesale, online and retail.
And how big's the team? It sounds like a lot of work.
It's growing very quickly. We've got a phenomenal one of our lead investors is a chap called Peter Littlewood, who is also an advisor as well. So his background, he used to head up the US Mars business. And then he's also was the founding chairman of Bulldog Skincare, the male skincare brand, and also an investor in Lexa Pip and Nut, and also an advisor in Jabel, the flavored beer. So he has an official role, not just as an investor. He's also a board advisor. So he's full time, if you like. And then after that, we've got six or seven freelancers with us now. They may vary from 10 hours a week up to practically full time. And that ranges from supply chain, marketing, social media, a fair amount of finance, the accountancy, and so on and so on. And so it's a growing team. And yeah, and that comes with all the normal joys and pressures.
The brand is striking. Is this your first? I mean, actually, if you sold your first can in March, I'm assuming this is the first pass at the brand, the first version of the brand, is it?
It is. My background's commercial and category, so I'm afraid I can take no credit for the design and the creativity behind the brand. But we work with a phenomenal graphic designer, Aisha Orm, who I've worked with before at a previous company, who's responsible for that kind of thing. She's worked for some major brands, and having her on board, we're very fortunate to have her. And it is the first pass. Equally, we did spend a lot of time and resource into it at the beginning. We don't want to be that brand that's changing up their cans, sort of. Every run they do, there are always going to be a couple of tweaks here and there, and you might be able to see that from the peach SKU versus the strawberry yuzu SKU, purely because we got the trademark of Vital over Vital at that point. But there will be some tweaks, but hopefully we're not changing all the time. Famous last words.
Can I ask how you've funded the business so far, and what has the process been like, or how has that worked for you?
We had an awesome group of industry heavyweights who were investors in us before we'd even decided committed to drinks. So they've been pivotal. We've raised hundreds of thousands of pounds off the back of it. Our investment criteria was quite strict, and I think relatively unusual. It was the three C's, so they obviously had to have spare capital, but the culture and content piece were the other two C's, were really strong for us. So on the content piece, they had to bring something. So the vast majority of our investors have an FMCG background, a lot of founders or a lot of VC or private equity backgrounds. Equally, doesn't have to be an FMCG background, but most of them are. It could be marketing elsewhere, legal, accountancy, finance. And the other element was culture. So we had capital, content, and culture. We did turn away a couple of big tickets, purely because we didn't think the culture fit was right. And that was very early on. And it's something we stood by from day one. And it's been definitely the right call. You do hear some horror stories of investors getting too involved, or potentially the ones who aren't so experienced are ultimately getting involved when they shouldn't. So we're very fortunate to have the investment team we do. And I'm sure there'll be more raises in the future.
When you mentioned the big ticket investors, was it easy to say no, or was it a bit of a soul searching moment, or
It's a very good question. I think awkward is the word that came that comes to mind first. That I think the different types of investors obviously vary, but the lots of them will be investing in you, and others will be investing in what you're going into. So some investors might be very people led, and others might be more data category led. And of course, you get the ones in the middle as well. And I think once we've been very fortunate enough to land some big names early. So once other investors see their portfolios and their backgrounds, they're also not just investing in either you or the brand or the company or the category or the product. They're also backing the other investors. So it's sort of a bit of a Rubik's Cube that's fighting back. Different investors want different things and obviously different ticket sizes. But it can be a bit of a scrap. I mean, some days you might everything might go against you, and other days you might have 2 6-figure tickets come in that you may not have expected. So I enjoyed the raising part. It's incredibly exciting, and it's sort of that adrenaline rush you get at the beginning of any brand. But it can be very tough at times.
Sounds like it's kind of momentum is the key thing here. It kind of feels like that's what you're driving as anything, is you're trying to keep this thing moving in the right direction and bringing the right people in at the right time. Is that how it feels to you?
Or? Yeah, exactly. I mean, you start with a sort of a big list. And I mean, the economic environment is well up in the air. You want to keep the momentum going, keep the ball rolling. But it can be very time consuming as well. But then you might land an investor and you might get introduced to five others, and let's say two of them, and they introduce you to a few more. I wouldn't say there's a sort of a set timetable of how to do it. It can be very tough, and it can be sporadic at times. And in the background, you're also launching a business and all the other joys and pains that comes with. So it can be tough, but I think we got that very right. There's lots of things we'd change, but the investment team and the figures that we raised, we got spot on.
Which kind of leads into the question I always ask people, which is, and I appreciate the lifetime of, actually, how long is the lifetime of Vital? The first can was in March.
First can was in March. I mean, we started to raise towards the end of last year, or maybe even early this year. But yeah, I mean, it's we sort of call March our
less than a year. I always ask people, if you could go back and tell you something that you learnt the hard way in the business, and if you'd known it back at the start, it would have saved you a whole load of pain or cost or frustration. Is there anything like that? Is there anything you wish you could change going back to the start of Vital?
Yeah, I could. I think I could write a few essays on it. I think the biggest one, and this is more sort of looking at it from a holistic sense, is don't over or underreact. It's very easy when it's obviously your baby. News comes in, good or bad, and you're either over the moon and you think, right, well, I'm going to be the next Innocent, or you're down in the dumps thinking, well, this company's going to fold tomorrow. The news is never as good or as bad as you think. So it's taking a slight rain check on yourself and either bringing yourself up or reining yourself in, which sounds like it's taking the fun out of the high moments, and it slightly is, but then you realize the high moment isn't quite as good as you thought, and it's great, but now you've got an absolute shed load of other work to do off the back of it, and it's only the start of it. Let's say if it's a launch or something. So it's don't over or under react. And the more I think about it, the more I try to do that, the more important I realize it is. Don't over or underreact to that is what I'd say.
Brilliant. That's really good advice. Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining, Al. If anyone wants to find out more about Vital and buy online, go to vital-drinks.co.uk. If you want to listen to more episodes of the Food Founders Interview, go to froghop.co.uk/podcast or search for Food Founders Interviews wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a follow or even a review. It all helps. Thanks again for joining us, Al. And good luck. I'm excited to see what 2025 brings.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thanks for having us on.